Okay, friends. By the way, before I start, there's a famous story about Golda Meir, who once met Nixon, and Nixon said to her, "You know, both of us have a Jewish Minister of Foreign Affairs. I have Henry Kissinger, and you have Abba Ibn." And Golda Meir said back to him, "That's true, but mine speaks English." I'm saying this because of my Dutch accent. I'm sorry about that. I can't get rid of it. My opinion about the Jewish tradition is that really something totally different is taking place than what and how we normally read it. I agree and I admit that conformity plays an important role. But I also think that at the same time, while it does, the Jewish tradition is not conform at all, in principle. There is a big difference between the practical side of what the Jewish tradition is all about and its ideological meaning, its very way how it looks to life, how it understands life. And I will try to explain that to you. As far as I can see and I understand what the Jewish tradition is all about, it is a tradition of pluralism. Obviously, pluralism doesn't mean that everything goes, not even in the secular sense of the word. Pluralism is always a carefully sought-out form of pluralism where certain borderlines cannot be defeated or for that reason violated because the structure will altogether start to fall apart and will pay an enormous price. Pluralism does not allow for anti-Semitism. Pluralism does not allow for looking down or behaving to other people with other color skins in ways which are unacceptable. Pluralism is not at all about that. Pluralism is speaking about a way how we allow for the diversity of human beings to have an opportunity to somehow live up to its own expectations of what it ultimately can do to allow man to become himself as an individual. Not that everything is just like that permitted. But before I go into this, I want you to know that it is true that in the Torah itself there is a law which is called Lotit Kodedu. And what it means in rabbinic terms is that indeed you must be careful that you don't create different communities of Jews which can no longer live together because each one goes his own way and is going on his own direction, and therefore on the end we will be left with such a kind of diversity that the unity of the Jewish people is undermined. There's always the problem of unity, the need to hold together, to make sure that as a nation, and we are after all very, very small, we are able to survive the most difficult circumstances. And on the other side, the very need that in that system we need to have people to have as much diversity and as many colors and as many different forms of symphony, let's say, as possible. I am not a halachic authority, but I know a lot about halacha. I don't want to be a posek, an halachic authority telling you what to do or not, because it goes against my nature. I believe that people need to make choices. But before I continue, I want you to be aware that what I'm going to argue for, and I really want you to take notice of that statement, is I'm not looking for leniencies for the sake of leniencies. It may be true that we have to make the Jewish tradition a little easier, but I'm very reluctant about making that statement, because easier to mean often means also, to many people it means, you know what, why should we get so involved? Let's keep it a little superficial so that I don't have to really commit myself totally and completely. I'm not speaking about that. Although I agree, by the way, in the halacha itself, it is definitely true, there's a concept in the Gemara in Beitza, which says, koach de hetera adif. The power of leniency is always preferred. True. The rabbis often, and many rabbis today have forgotten about this, rabbis are there indeed to find a lenient kind of ruling, because life sometimes requires that. But that is not the motivation of what I'm going to say. Because I don't want to make the impression, because I don't believe in it, that we need to have a more lenient form of living just to make it ourselves easier. I don't believe that life needs to be easier. Life needs to be more meaningful. It must have a deeper religious meaning. That's what I'm concerned about. We need more authenticity. We need more integrity. I make another statement before I start. As I mentioned at the beginning, and I want you to remind yourself of that while I'm speaking, for any argument I'm going to make, I know there are arguments against it. I can quote you them by page from the Talmud. You can come afterwards up to me and say, Robert Kadosa, but doesn't it say like this there? And I will finish you the sentence, because I know what you're speaking about. But I'm speaking about something very different. I'm speaking about the question about whether this is the only view which you would use against me, or that there are definitely other views which somehow were put under the carpet over the years within the Jewish tradition by the rabbis, for perhaps very good reasons at the time, which now I feel we are in need of to reveal them, to get them out of the carpet and put them on top of the list. Why? Because the circumstances under which we live today require that, in my opinion. Let's look into something. You know, many of you know this from Thursday night and from what I've said before here in Toronto. I come from a completely secular background. I mentioned to some of you on Thursday night, I come from a mixed marriage. I had a non-Jewish mother and a Jewish father. I converted when I was 16 years old. My mother, I got her so much to get her in love that she also converted. My parents married each other half a year before I got married. I'm the only child in the world who can make that statement. But I'm saying this for one good reason, because obviously every shiur is an autobiography. You come in with your own personal experience when you speak. There's no way out of this. One of the most marvelous things which I love about the Jewish tradition is that it is a tradition of constant disagreement. You sometimes, and I sometimes, complain about the rabbis that can't make up their mind if it is A or B. And I tell you, I love it if they fight each other. Why? Because it shows the vitality of the Jewish tradition. Any tradition which has a final answer to any of its problems dies, by definition. Any particular tradition which continues to discuss, to argue, to disagree, is a particular tradition which ultimately will always win. Can be frustrating, I agree, because if you go to Rabbi A, he tells you like this, and you go to Rabbi B, he tells you something else. But on the larger picture, it is a marvelous thing that this diversity takes place. And have a look in the Talmud. Every page of the Talmud is a disagreement. There is no codex there at all. Most of the time there are no final conclusions. The conclusions were drawn later by the rabbis, when there was no doubt a need for it on a pragmatic level. You have to know if you go for A or go for B. You can't do B and A at the same time. But the very fact that at the beginning everything was open to discussion, besides a few matters I come to in a moment, that has always been the point of departure within the Jewish tradition. We have, as we call it in Hebrew, machloket, diversity, or differences of opinion. We have dispute. The marvelous thing about this Talmud is that it is an ongoing dispute where people disagree. We do not understand how vital and how unique that is in the whole of human history as far as literature is concerned. There is no other tradition in the world which disagrees as much with each other than within the Jewish tradition. Then we have not only hundreds of opinions about everything, we have also majority opinions and minority opinions. Majority opinions are normally in according to which we ultimately live our halachic life. We have something like Acharei HaRabim LaHatot. You shall go in according to the majority view. Why? We have to understand still. But there is definitely a minority opinion. And what is so remarkable in the Talmud is that a minority opinion is always quoted. It was never pushed from the table. You can ask yourself the obvious question. If in any way we don't go by the minority opinion, why mention it? But it is mentioned everywhere. And the Talmud would not be the Talmud if it was not, because it constantly keeps on telling us, but this man had a minority opinion and he completely disagreed with the other one. Even when everybody knows quite well that we will go by the majority opinion when it comes to our personal halachic way of living. What happened in later Jewish history, for good reasons, I will not deny that, is that we streamlined it all. We made it all to flow one way. We all followed this opinion and we no longer follow that opinion. And there are good reasons why we had to do that, because we probably would not have survived without it, because we would have fallen apart in many different pieces with many different Jewish communities. It completely clash, and there would never be any Jewish unity left. But, and here comes my but, the way in which we have been doing this up till now to hold on to that unity and therefore streamline the whole of the halakha, I wonder, in all honesty, if it still works today for the reasons, or better, for the needs, the religious needs which our generation needs and has. I'm going to also use another word. I wonder if we should not unfreeze the halakha. Because the halakha got somewhere frozen. The streamlining is the freezing of the halakha. It now becomes one way, one road. Which, by the way, is exactly the meaning of the word orthodox. The word orthodox means one way. But the word orthodoxy really doesn't fit at all the Jewish tradition. Because if you look into the sources, and these are after all, first of all, the Talmud, then you see that there is no orthodox Judaism, purely because there are so many ways where the rabbis completely disagreed about the most important issues. What we have to realize is that today we may have to rethink about this, and what I say, to unfreeze that what got frozen, because we live today in a sha'at chirum. We live today in an emergency condition. If a majority, the vast majority of the Jewish people today, are no longer living in according to Jewish tradition, have done totally away with it, and let's be honest, the amount of religious Jews in the world is small compared to those who are not, then we have an emergent situation as we have never had before since I don't know when. And that is serious, incredibly serious, because we are losing people left and right, and these are serious people. And you know what? Let me tell you another thing which people sometimes don't realize. The people who have walked away are not by definition irreligious people. It is not because they just didn't care less. It is because it didn't speak anymore to them. Because it is no longer that what they are looking for when it comes to religious terms. How often have I not spoken to young people, fantastic people, Israelis, non-Israelis, who tell me, you know, I would like to be religious, but if I look into this world of halakha, what has this to do with religion? They often obviously think in terms of Christianity, because Christianity doesn't know so much about halakha. There's more about the religious experience. And very often Christianity has misused it totally and has created a tremendous amount of trouble, first of all for us, but for themselves as well. But the religious experience, the feeling that I live in the presence of God, that there's a mysterium taking place, that there are ultimate things taking place which are beyond our understanding, but which I feel in my very body and in my blood. These are things which loads of people, including loads of Israelis, are looking for. And we don't give it to them, because what do? We come with the Shulchan Aruch. We come with the Codex of Jewish Law, and we'll tell them, you want to live a Jewish religious life? Here's the Codex. And then they respond, I'm not speaking at all about that. I'm speaking about living in the presence of God. And if we don't show them that living in the presence of God has something to do with this halakha, then halakha indeed becomes meaningless. And we are exactly, my dear friends, doing that. And a good part of our rabbis and our rabbinates are doing that. If today I hear in Israel, where I live already for many years, that loads of Israelis are going off to the Far East to find spirituality over there, with the gurus and with the Dalai Lama, who by the way is a big man, a great man, and they can't find it in our synagogues next door in Tel Aviv, then there is something basically wrong about the whole way how we function. I started last month, I shall not go into this now, a center for secular Israelis in the middle of the heart of secular Tel Aviv. I'm not going to make them frum, religious, but I'm going to show them the incredible greatness of the Jewish tradition, which afterwards they have to deal with on their own and do whatever they like to do with it. But I am obligated, absolutely obligated, to give them that opportunity, because I wonder, why are you going off to the guru? Well, in fact, we have it ourselves better than anybody else. Do you know that not so long ago the Dalai Lama came to Israel? He's been a few times there. And he had an massive amount of Israelis in Tel Aviv, I think it was, who came to listen to him. And he said one thing to them, which was mind-boggling. He said to them, why are you coming to me? I'm coming to you. I came to Israel because I wanted to learn, how do you survive in exile? I'm in exile, as you know, the Dalai Lama. How did you manage to stay alive in exile? You have your Jewish tradition, you don't need Buddhism, you don't need the Dalai Lama. You have your own stuff, hold on to it. And these Israelis were completely surprised, because this was the last thing they ever would think the Dalai Lama would tell them. But you know, the rule is, if a non-Jew tells you that Judaism is great, you listen. If the rabbis tell you, you won't listen. That's the way how it is. I'm serious. Now, before I continue, and I hope you follow my strange way of journeying here, I want you to know one thing. I believe we have to unfreeze the halakha, and I'll show you later what I mean by that. I think we need to do that because we are in a gerum, we are in an emergency situation as we have never been before. But obviously, I have to set my standards. I personally, and I say this with the greatest amount of respect, I don't agree with reforming conservative Judaism. I don't think the solution is there. By the way, there's a lot to learn from them. No doubt. But I personally don't go for their approach, because I don't see the light on the end of the tunnel. What I do believe is this. There is one thing which is untouchable, because otherwise the whole thing cracks down and nothing is left. And these are what we call the Taryak Mitzvot, the 613 commandments. What I mean by that is this. In the Torah, I shall not go into the question how we got to 613, which is a big problem, by the way. But the fact is that we speak today about 613 commandments, Taryak Mitzvot. They are, we say in Hebrew, midoraita. They are biblical. We as Jews believe And I know there's a lot of discussion about it, and I can speak for hours about it, which I won't. We believe that these were given by God to Moshe and to the Jewish people at Sinai. Not only what is written in the Torah, but also what is written, or better, the oral interpretation of these 613. The text, we are not a text people. We are not reading just the text and say, like the Karaites did, or perhaps the Bible Belt is doing. We are reading, no doubt, the 613 commandments as they are understood within the oral tradition. And I'm not going to dare to undermine that, because I believe that then everything falls apart. They are untouchable for me, as they are understood by the Torah, Shabbat, by the oral tradition. But the moment we start to speak about rabbinical law, which are after all laws made by man and not by God, although God no doubt said that the rabbis were and perhaps even obligated to create these laws so that they will function as a kind of a gate, as a kind of, let's say, security by which the actual laws themselves should not get being violated, I ask myself the question, in all honesty, if the rabbinical laws, as we have them today, should always be applied in every occasion, when sometimes the purpose of these rabbinical laws are perhaps doing more the opposite of that what they should be doing. They were given and created by our great rabbis, and they were very great rabbis, no doubt about it, for the reason to increase our spiritual religiosity, to get a deeper feeling of what God is all about and how we live in the presence of God. But the question is, are they still doing that? Do they still function like that? Do we have in that way indeed a future for the Jewish people? Have a look. As I said before, everywhere there is nearly a difference of opinion. The most famous differences of opinion are found in the Mishnah, for example, between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel. We all know about that. The two great houses of Jewish learning. We nearly always live in according to Beit Hillel. The laws as they are stated by the house of Hillel, there are one or two exceptions to that particular rule. The Talmud tells us a very interesting thing about it. I'm going to read you this. This is in Iruvin, in the Talmud, in 13b. For 3 years, says the Talmud, very famous statement, there was a dispute between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel about loads of different issues. Most important, most of them were purely rabbinical. The former asserting the halakha is like me, and the other saying, no, the halakha is like me. Then a bat kol, an heavenly voice, came and said, here this is marvelous stuff. Elu ve elu divrei Elokim chayim. These and those are the words of the living God. Meaning that God, in according to the Talmudic tradition, is saying, I want you to know, Beit Shammai is right and Beit Hillel is right. But, continues that particular story, while they are both right, the halakha should be in according to Beit Hillel. Comes the Talmud and asks the question, why is the halakha in according to Beit Hillel? And the Talmud gives a remarkable answer which you would not expect. You would expect that the answer is that Beit Hillel is right and Beit Shammai is wrong. But the Talmud just told us that they are not. They're both right. So what can then be the reason why one is indeed the one which we follow and the other one not? Answers the Talmud the following remarkable statement. It says, you know why? Why do we follow Beit Hillel? Because in any dispute between these two houses, Beit Hillel always mentioned the opinion of Beit Shammai first. Humility. A matter of respect. I will disagree with you, but you know what? The way how we disagree is that I first will defend your position and then I will tell you why I don't agree. Says the Talmud, for that very reason, God said to the Jewish people, you know what? You follow Beit Hillel. Has this anything to do with truth? No. It has to do with another matter. It has to do with a matter of kavod habriot, a matter of which has to do with the honor of your fellow man, that you realize that indeed the most important thing how you can live a religious Jewish life is when you indeed take that constantly into account. The whole of Jewish law follows most of the time Beit Hillel, because Beit Hillel was more humble than Beit Shammai. My dear friends, nowhere in the world will you ever find that the dispute was somehow settled that way. Not because of the truce, but because of the kavod of my fellow man, because of the honor of my fellow man. That's already an indicator. Something else is going on, in other words. And then there is something else which is very important to remind ourselves of. The Talmud says that there were very great differences of opinion between Beit Hillel and Beit Hillel, Beit Shammai, which kind of women you are allowed to marry. There are certain women you're not allowed to marry. And they disagreed which women they are. Says the Talmud like this: Va'afal pi she'elu osrim ve'elu matirim. And also there were differences of opinion between Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel about which ones you are allowed to marry. I'm speaking about all sort of conditions here which we shall not go into now, and which you are not allowed to get married. Elu poslim ve'elu machshirim. There were those who said yes, and there were those who said no. Lo nimnu Beit Shammai milisan nashim me Beit Hillel. Still, Beit Shammai did not stop marrying the women from the house of Beit Hillel, and Beit Hillel was not stopping itself to marry the women from Beit Shammai. What does that mean? It means this: the pshat in the Gemara, the straightforward understanding of the Gemara, is that Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel indeed had differences of opinion, and they lived accordingly. But to make sure that they would afterwards not have a major problem, that the whole thing would split up into two parts, and you would have a Jewish tradition of Beit Hillel, and you would have a Jewish tradition of Beit Shammai, so what did they do? They used to inform each other about this particular woman, in according to your opinion, can't marry this man. In according to my opinion, we can. In according to your opinion, I cannot. I give you that piece of information. But all the other cases where we have no difference of opinion, our men and our women will marry together. There was unity in diversity, in other words. There was a constant in the issue of wanting to make sure that we will stay a unity, but we will indeed still continue to live in according to our own halachic understanding. The big problem then is, which I shall not go into this now, is what is the meaning of this statement, the bat kol, that there was a bat kol which says you will always have to go in according to Beit Hillel. Well, we know that in practice that was not always the case. They continued to do what they did. There's a lot of talk about it. I shall not go into this now. But it sets something in motion. What it sets in motion is this. I will ask a very radical question. And I only do that theoretically, because I know it is much more complicated than that. What would happen in a case when somebody would say, you know what, Beit Shammai speaks more to my soul than Beit Hillel. I feel more in according to Beit Shammai. I give you one or two minor cases, but there are major cases as well. You know, there's a machloket. It's only a small one, but it's a very interesting one. How do you kindle the lights of the menorah on Chanukah? Beit Shammai says you should start with 8, the next day 7, and the last day 1. Beit Hillel says exactly the reverse. 1 first, like we do today, till the 8th and last day. Now the reason behind that is deep. The reason behind that has a lot to do with the way how you feel your religious experience. Most people in this world, when they start living their Chanukah experience, and it should be an experience, it should be a religious experience, they have this feeling like, you know, the first day I'm just getting into it. The second day I got more heated up. The third day even more, so therefore the last day is the explosion. That's the reason why Beit Hillel says from 1 till 8. Beit Shammai says, I don't agree, I don't feel it at all like that. I tell you how I feel. The first day is the explosion. You know why? Because then it is new, it is novel. I walk into something I'm not yet used to it. That is the most exciting moment. 8 days. Eight lights. The second day I'm already getting a little bit used to it. 7. Third day I'm even more used to it. 6. The last day is nearly gone, only one. These are two deeply ways of a religious experience. We say today that we will follow for all sort of reasons Beit Hillel. I'm asking, and obviously I only used it as a symbol. What happens if some student comes to me and says, Robert Cardoso, I really would like to go in according to Beit Shammai because for me the first day is the most exciting day. Should I say to him, forget about it? Or should I say, listen here, that's the opinion in the Talmud. And also we normally go in according to Beit Hillel. In your case, we should make an exception to the rule because that's the way how you feel about it. Because what I'm interested in is that the man is excited about the mitzvah of the menorah, of lighting the menorah. I give you another example, which I'm personally very much dealing with. I don't know about you. I find prayer an incredible difficult thing to do three times a day. I'm being told by the Shulchan Aruch, by the Codex of Jewish Law, to pray in the morning, to pray in the afternoon, and pray in the evening. I go to shul. But that disturbs me, I tell you honestly. This is a piece of autobiography. It disturbs me. I do it. But it disturbs me, I'll tell you why. Because I sometimes feel that I walk out of that shul and I'm not anywhere different from the way I walked in. What I mean is this. The Gemara in Eruvin 65a says the following. One should not pray any prayer when one comes home from a journey. Why? Because at the time when you come home from a journey, your mind is not a prayer. Don't pray. Here another one. One should not pray when one just has been annoyed. If you were angry, don't pray. That is the original halacha in the Gemara. It says about Rabbi Hanina, who was one of the big sages of the time. I read you straight from the Talmudic text in English. Rabbi Hanina did not pray on the day that he became angry. Interesting, the rabbis sometimes became angry as well. They're all human beings. And they didn't pray. Should I now pray when I'm angry? Or when I come home from a big journey? Should I pray or not? Comes the Shulchan Aruch, the Codex of Jewish Law, and says, one should not indeed pray in a place where there are distractions. In other words, it opens up the whole thing. Whenever you are distracted, don't pray, because then your mind is here and your prayers are there. There's no point in doing that. Continues, however, the Shulchan Aruch, the Rabbi Yosef Karo, nowadays we take no notice of all this, since in any way we have no concentration. You hear what happens over here? We have in any way no concentration. So if you want to be honest with yourself, you will never pray anymore. Because you never have a concentration. Okay. Then the Talmud says, Gemaraim Brachot 36b, says, what happens in a case when you did not pray with kavanah, with intention? Should you repeat the prayer? This time is intention, yes or no? Says the Talmud, yes. If you prayed and afterwards you came to the conclusion that you did not really say it with the right intention, just repeat it. In fact, the Shulchan Aruch states this. Comes the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, great Ashkenazi scholar, and says, you should not repeat. Why not? Because the second time you will also say it without Kavanah. You will also say it without any intention. So what is the point? You haven't done anything. You didn't get anything better because of it. Now I can fully follow this way of logic. But there is a certain danger in all this. The danger is that at the same time what we are doing over here is the trivialization of prayer. It becomes automatic. It gets streamlined. What is happening now is we pray three times a day. I came from a journey. I was just angry. It doesn't matter anymore because it doesn't make any difference anymore. Because in any way, you don't have the right of intention. True, that's probably true. But remember, there's a big difference here. And it's serious. Our grandparents, when they prayed and they couldn't pray with the right intention, you know what? They walked away disturbed. They said, I didn't make it today. I couldn't do it. I didn't live up to my duties, to what I have to do. Remember one thing, you know, the Talmud says prayer is a chutzpah. Why is prayer a chutzpah? Prayer is a chutzpah for one good reason. How do you dare to speak to the Lord of the universe? Who are you to speak to me? I'm always afraid that when I pray to God and I say how great he is, Hakil, Hakadol, Hakibur, Vahanora, that somebody from up there, God will say down to me, Cardoso, who are you to tell me how great I am? It's the most disturbing thing. Who are you to tell me, Hakil, Hakadol, Hakibur, Vahanora, as if I am on his level to tell him how great he is? So there are problems here. But our grandparents, at least, they were terribly disturbed when they walked out of shul and they said, you know what, I didn't make it. And probably their whole day was spoiled. In Israel, we have on the back of a car, you sometimes see one nuclear bomb can spoil your whole day. It's the same thing here as well. One missed opportunity or proper prayer, and it can destroy your whole day. That's the way how our grandparents lived. I don't know about you, I can only speak about myself. If I didn't pray with intention, which happens very often, I walk out, I'm not disturbed. My life just continues like it did before. And then I'm looking back and I'm asking myself one question. Would it not be better that I go back to the original ruling in the Talmud, where it says, if you can't pray with prayer, keep your mouth shut. Keep your mouth shut. You know why? It has completely lost the point. What you are doing now is the trivialization of prayer. Did the Rama mean it like that? No. He was speaking on a much deeper level because people were disturbed. But we are not even disturbed anymore, my friends. And so there are loads of examples where we can go around and we have to ask ourselves, and that's what I want to get to, is the question, should we not go back to the Talmudic halacha, not what later was done because of all sort of different circumstances, but ask ourselves, let's stay authentic above everything else. Perhaps better that I say only one shachrit prayer and not say mincha and ma'arif, because I know I'm not going to say it the correct way. Perhaps instead that I say the mincha prayer, I should meditate for a quarter of an hour and indeed disturb myself about the fact that I was not able to make it. My friends, please do me a big favor. Don't misuse that by telling yourself to this afternoon, I won't pray mincha anymore and you watch television. That's the last thing what I have in mind. What I want you to do is that you don't pray prayer and then afterwards you are disturbed. You're annoyed with yourself because you couldn't pray. If you do that, then I permit you as a rabbi not to pray. But if you're going instead of that, watch television, forget about it. One has to be honest about these things above everything else. What I'm saying, in other words, I hope you understand, is this. We are individuals. I say a Berlin is right. There are no final fixing things by which everything goes and everything falls in place. We are different, each one of us, with different colors, with different feelings, with different emotions. We play the music differently. And I show you how interesting. There is a Marashal. Marashal was one of the great poskei, one of the great halachic authorities, who writes like this. It says in the Gemara in Eruvin something like this. When Moshe ascended to receive the Torah, it was demonstrated to him that every matter was subject to 49 lenient and 49 stringent approaches. When he inquired about this by God, God responded that the scholars of each generation were given the authority to decide among these perspectives in according to their own views how to establish the halakha. God said to the Jewish people and to the rabbis at the time, I am not going to tell you what the halakha is. I just give you the general rules, the foundations of it. It is up to you to decide what to do with it, in according to your own personal havana, your personal understanding. Comes the Maharashal and says something beautiful, which is found in many different other places. He says, one should not be astonished by the range of debate and argumentation in matters of halakha. All these views are in the category of Elu ve'elu divrei Elokim chayim. These and those are the words of the living God. This is so despite the fact that Moshe never projected opposing perspectives with respect to any one issue. The Kabbalists, hear this, explain that the basis for this difference of opinion between the rabbis, that both of these views are coming from God, is that each individual soul was present at Sinai and received the Torah by means of 49 tzinorot, a kind of vessels by which they came down to us. Each perceived the Torah from his own perspective. Hear this. Each one received the Torah from his own perspective, in accordance with his intellectual and emotional capacity, as well as the stature and the unique character of his particular soul. Each person is another world. This accounts for the discrepancy in perception, inasmuch as one concluded that an object was tamei. Sometimes from one point of view something is impure, from another point of view it is pure. It all depends, he says, all these rules are sensible views. Thus the wise man, the great sages, declared that in debate between true scholars, all position articulated represent the truth. I'm going to put this in my own words. You know what they're saying over here? What they're saying over here, people are different. People have different needs. People have different religious needs. People have different inclinations, feelings, emotions. Those who received the Torah at Sinai did not receive one and the same Torah. What they only received, all of them the same, whatever that may mean, is that the Taryak Mitzvot, the very biblical commandments, came down to them, probably in a more or less in a similar way. But how they understood them, how they felt about them, how they felt a certain uplifting experience because of them, each one was totally different. Subjective to their inclinations, one person writes, of individuals infested in the perspective of how he understands the Torah. Why, in other words, then, is there a machloket, a difference of opinion between all the rabbis, constantly throughout all of the Talmud? The answer is, you know why the difference of opinions? Because they're different people. Because they're different kind of Jews. One has got that kind of a musical soul, and also one has another kind of a musical soul. Don't start to streamline them. And by the way, that's the reason when the Codex of Jewish Law was written, first by Maimonides and afterwards by Rabbi Yosef Karo, there was an enormous amount of objection against the very fact that they were codifying all this. Because people wrote, you can read this today, still in our works, Maimonides was attacked for the fact that, why do you dare to finalize Jewish law? You decide that it is like this and not like that, the machloket between Rabbah and Abaya. Why don't you leave that up to every generation to decide in according to its own understanding and its own feelings and its own emotions? And many great commentators have written that against Maimonides, and later they wrote this also against the Shulchan Aruch, the Codex of Jewish Law. Do not misunderstand me. The Codex of Maimonides is an unbelievable piece of masterly piece. So it is true about the Shulchan Aruch. These are holy works. I do not deny that for one moment. But the question still is, does, especially in our days in which we live, do we still have to live by them in a war in the way how our grandparents did when they lived under completely different circumstances and they did not have that incredible feeling of autonomy like we have today? You and I live an autonomous life. Even when it comes to our living in according to the Torah, we, because we are independent beings, have decided to live in according to the Torah. If I don't want to do that, well, nobody will stop me from doing that. There is no law of the country that will tell me, not even in Israel, tell me that I must observe Shabbat. It is my autonomy which decides on that. That's, by the way, the reason why there is absolutely no rabbinical authority today anymore. A rabbinical authority only agrees, is only there when I am prepared to say to the rabbi, you are my authority. But he has no power, really, to do anything beyond that. He can't bring in a police force to tell me that I need to listen to him. So what I'm asking is, should we not go back to the big differences of opinion, the many different attitudes which the Talmud had, and offer that to our people today and say, we will no longer mainstream, or better, streamline the Jewish tradition. We obviously need to make sure that you know all the positions, all the colors, all the different possibilities which are there, and make a choice. Make a choice. What you feel you're up to. Under one condition. And I repeat that specifically here. Never use this as a way of making it yourself easy. Never say, you know what, okay, you know, there's one opinion which is definitely the Bohemian, so I will hold by that opinion. That's not at all. The question which concerns us here is, how shall I live in the presence of God? How shall I live with Yirat Shamayim, with the awe of God, in a way that we will really understand that we are living in His presence? And here I come to another halachic issue. There are several rules in the Talmud which are remarkable, which all come down to the same principle. They are sometimes called hora'at sha'a, which means something like a temporary decision made by the rabbis, where they say, well, what was all done up till now, we will no longer do, because the times in which we live require a different approach. Or there is a statement by the Talmud, shebitula shil Torah zehu yesoda, which means to say that sometimes the suspension of a law of the Torah is its very foundation. There were moments in Jewish history where the Nevi'im or other great people said, let's not apply this law of the Torah now at this stage, because it will actually work against our experience of God. The famous example is, as you all know, Eliyahu on the Har Carmel, on the mountain Carmel, when he brought an offering to God outside the temple, which was absolutely forbidden. But he did so because at the time there was a need to do that. Long story, we shall not go into this now. Maimonides writes about Hora'at Sha'ah, or about Eit La'asot La'shem Hefiru Torateha, which means another rule, which says something like this. It is time to fight for God by, let me put it in very extreme terms, undermining His Torah. Meaning to say that there may be moments when we have to do things against the Torah so that we ultimately will also uplift that Torah in the eyes of the people. Maimonides writes in the Guide of the Perplex, so too, if in order to bring back the multitudes to religion and save them from general religious laxity, it may be required sometimes to do away with a rabbinical law. And he even speaks about the case where we do away with a biblical law. And I'm not even speaking about that. I don't think we should touch that. But why not allow for minority opinions? Why not allow for also opinions which we have not accepted? And let me add one or two more petters and then I will stop. And I'm opening up here something which I'm not going to close for you, because it will take hours to explain that. Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz, Professor Eliezer Berkowitz, one of the great Jewish philosophers of our days, in his book about halacha, which perhaps you have read or you have seen, there's an English translation of it as well, ha-halacha ha-tafkida, the purpose, let's say, the goals of the halacha, he writes something even more extreme, which I don't know yet what to do with it, but it's very interesting. He says, you know what, the whole halacha today is a galut halacha. It is an exiled halacha. He says it's a halacha built on the principle that if we live between the non-Jews, it is a protective and defensive halacha to keep us going. But he calls for a very extreme concept. He says, now that we are back in Israel and we live in our own world, we should stop having that kind of halacha and go back to the original halacha, which should not be defensive and protective, but we should be outgoing. Now, what he seems to indicate there is a very dangerous topic, and that is, he seems to say something like, even the Talmud, which already is an exiled halacha, it was written in exile in Babylon, it therefore is also not the original thing, because there was a halacha before the Talmud, which was not exiled halacha, but which was what he calls Eretz Yisrael halacha. And I mention here an opinion of Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Kook, the chief rabbi of Israel, who writes somewhere that the reason why we should give more attention to the Yerushalmi, that is the Jerusalem Talmud, over the Babylonian Talmud, is because the Jerusalem Talmud was written in Israel. And because it was written in Israel, it has less exiled halacha in there. And by the way, the Talmud, the Jerusalem Talmud, is much more difficult to learn than the Babylonian Talmud, because it is much more brought together in a few words, and you have to read a lot into it to understand what it is. He, in fact, goes as far as to say that the Babylonian Talmud was not reading this, not written by nevuah, by absolute prophecy, and that the Yerushalmi, the Palestinian, today called the Jerusalem Talmud, was actually written with prophecy, and therefore we should look in that direction. The consequences of that are enormous. I shall not go into this now, and I don't even know where it will end. But the fact that it is to be discussed, and that I think that the halachic authorities today have to look into this, is to me crucial. My friends, I will finish with a few more pragmatic ways of dealing with this. I would suggest, for example, that especially in Israel, where there's a majority of Israelis who need to have some kind of religious affiliation, who are looking for that, but we cannot offer them a shul service like we have here, and where we have hours of shul service which doesn't speak at all to them, we really need to think about the fact, if we can find a way to make that shul service different, perhaps shorter, more deeper meaning, perhaps with more hasbara, with more explanations and things like that, so that when the Israeli walks in, he says, hey, that speaks to me. In fact, I am doing this now with a group of other rabbis in Tel Aviv, in the heart of Tel Aviv, because there's a tremendous need for that. Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, many people want to go to shul, but they won't walk into an Orthodox shul, because they get overwhelmed by all these incredible things that they have no idea about what it is all about, and nobody explains anything to them. Why not to create a completely different shul service? Most of the things which we do in shul are rabbinic. And that would be because it is a shaat chirum, because it is an emergency situation, there are no doubt opportunities to change some of these things, to make it more inducive to the people who are looking for some kind of a religious experience. I ask, tell you something else. There is an opinion in the later poskim by one of the great Sephardi authorities. He was the Ben Ishai, Rabbi Yosef Chaim Mebagdad, 19th century. There's a teshuvah of his, a responsum, where he writes, I can show it to you if you want, that people are permitted to drive on bicycles on Shabbat. If you go today to the Syrian community in Brooklyn, you will see that people on Shabbat go to shul, quite a few of them, on a bicycle, if there's an eruv, when you can't carry. He says, why? Because I can't see any reason why bicycles are forbidden on Shabbat. Now, this is a minority opinion. The majority of rabbis would not agree with that. I'm asking one question. In a place like Tel Aviv, in a place like Jerusalem, and also places like that, where people would like to visit their parents on Shabbat, but they live far away, you know what happens? What happens is that they say, well, we will take the car, we need to go to our parents, and since in any way I'm violating Shabbat, then it doesn't matter anymore if I violate the rest as well. So I wrote an article, and I said in there, why not to suggest these people, let them go by bicycle? By bicycle, you are not, definitely not midoraita, and probably not even midorabbanan or rabbinical law, you are allowed to take the bicycle and go that way to your parents, and then you can not, you can actually observe Shabbat. Now, it's a minority opinion, no doubt. Nearly nobody agrees with them. But why can't they use it at this particular hour of emergency? If somebody wants to make, a group of young people came to me and they said to me, you know what, I would like, when I eat, I would like to say a bracha different from the rabbis. Hamotzi lichem min haaretz doesn't speak to me. Can I say another bracha? So I would say to him, first of all, be aware that when the rabbis formulated this bracha, it was tremendous. I think it's the highest of the highest. But I agree with one thing, if it doesn't speak to you, if you say your own bracha, that's not the end of the world. Nothing really has happened. You know what I sometimes feel? That the tefillot, the prayers which we are saying, are so beautiful that I can't catch them anymore. That I have to be having less beautiful prayers which at least speak to me, because I can't get to that level on which the rabbis wrote these particular prayers. So what will be if we do that? Does that destroy the Jewish tradition? I don't think it will do exactly the reverse. I tell you on also side what I would like to do. And I mean getting in dangerous grounds here. I would like to forbid people reading newspapers on Shabbat. I think it's a disaster, to be quite honest. Because people continue to live their weekday life if they start to read the politics, especially Israeli politics, and the economics and the finances and everything like that. That's not what Shabbat is all about. Now, in according to the halakha, you're allowed to read a newspaper on Shabbat. But it's absolutely not in according to its spirit. People are, I spoke about that yesterday in Shul here, people are carrying on Shabbat in most big cities because we have an eruv, because there is a surrounding by which all of this is considered to be private domain. But I think somewhere it is not a very healthy situation because there's something very beautiful about not carrying on Shabbat. I mentioned to some rabbis in England, the rabbinical court over there, perhaps they should tell to their followers, once in 6 weeks, don't carry, even when there is an eruv. You know why? Keep the idea alive. A man needs to carry himself on Shabbat and not an object. Loads of other examples. When I speak about giyur, which is a major problem at the moment in Israel, conversion, I'm concerned that people get converted when there's nowhere any commitment at all. I don't think that's a healthy situation. On the other side, I don't know if we have to say to people that they always have to walk with a kippah on their head. Because I can prove you that in the olden days, the rabbis did not even walk with a kippah on their head. The kippah is a very late addition in Jewish law. Moshe Rabbeinu probably didn't have a kippah at all. Do they have to keep every commandment, every rabbinical commandment, and sign a decree and a statement that they will live by all these laws of the rabbis? I doubt very much we should do that. We should ask them to keep the laws of the Torah, the biblical laws. There are many other examples. There are many possibilities there. I'm only saying one thing, my dear friends. In the Jewish tradition, there is much greater amount of possibilities and flexibilities and diversities possible than what we are aware of. And I only took you this morning on a particular journey where I did not end. Because I don't know where it will end, because it needs much more study. But I think it is high time that our halachic authorities start to think about this. And that they realize that the beauty is that there are so much differences of opinion, and that man is able to choose in a world which today is a world of autonomy, where man needs to have the freedom to say, I decided how I am being religious. And not that somebody comes and coerces me into this, because I tell you one thing, you can't teach religion. You can neither inherit it from your parents. All what they can do is to give you the instruments to discover it yourself. Like I said at the very beginning, it can't be a prepared experience. It must ultimately come from our souls. And the halakha should be structured to make that possible. At the moment that is not the case, but it should become the case again, because by that we open up many people, including many Israelis, who would say, well, if that's what the halakha is all about, it is really a way to allow me to decide myself how I will find God. Obviously, within a certain structural condition, then I think in that way we will get many more people inside which are no outside. May God give us the opportunity to make that possible. Thank you very much.
Rabbi? Okay, it's late, but we still have a few minutes left, and maybe we'll go a couple minutes over time. Maybe we can leave. I'm going to take you two or three questions at the microphone in order, because we don't have time. Two, three questions, one round. We'll be out of here in 10 minutes. I think that's only fair. We like to keep on schedule. And
I just wanted to raise the potential comparison or equivalence of the things you're talking about and what the Baal Shem Tov's revolution was about. Yes. I am not into Hasidut myself on a practical level, but I think that the history of the Hasidic movement and what their rebellion was in a sense against Zitvashah Halacha seems to me in many ways a parallel to the things you're talking about today. I wonder if you wanted to just touch on that.
Yes, that is absolutely true. The early Hasidic thinkers, the early Hasidic thinkers, if you go to not what it is today, there is no Hasidism today. In the earlier Hasidic thinkers after the Baal Shem Tov, the Kotzke Rebbe, the people who are in that generation, when you read their writings, you see what they are doing over there is they are rebelling against the kind of halakha which was more in the conventional communities. They wanted to break out. They never wanted to break out completely, but they exactly dealt with this particular issue. And I'll dare to say, I don't have it here with me, if you look into some Hasidic texts of these days, you wouldn't believe your eyes on what they dared to write. If they would write this today, they would be considered to be heretics of the first order. But in the Lithuanian world, yeah, today. But today everybody would condemn them. And at that time, there was definitely this issue, which was the great breakaway. And this is the reason why the Gaon of Vilna opposed the Hasidic movement, because he was afraid that they would break away from halakha altogether. But it's true. The Satmar Rebbe once said, who was a major figure, in a particular sense of the word, he once said, today there are no misnachtim anymore. He said to his Hasidim. So the old Hasidim said, Baruch Hashem, there are no misnachtim. They also are opposing the Hasidim. He says, you know why? Because there are no Hasidim anymore.
I have to say, authentically, I'm more of a Hasidic leaning, and I have a number of questions to what you said. Number one, first of all, I would like to clarify if what you're talking about is in order to bring the large number of Jews closer to Judaism, that there are ways of bringing them in within halacha that is a flexible way. But you're not actually saying that people who are already on a level of observance could take a step backwards from where they are now. That's my first question, is whether you are actually saying that if somebody's finding their life not really an authentic observance for whatever reason, that they should feel okay about taking a step back on whatever point. So can I go on with my other questions?
Well, let me just straight away answer that. Okay. In short, yes, no doubt, you're quite right. I am of that opinion. I think that orthodoxy got completely stagnated about many of these issues, and that indeed we have to step backwards and look into all this again and use indeed these kind of approaches I just mentioned. I'm not saying this, in other words, only for those who are not religious, but I'm even saying this about those who are religious who have lost it somehow. Yes, definitely the case.
Okay, I would also like to address the subject of galut, because you were talking about the Talmud that was a Galut Talmud, and that we should now try to approach halacha, since we have Eretz Yisrael and we're in Eretz Yisrael, that we should try to, you know, maybe embrace more of a less Galut mentality or the Yerushalmi Talmud. But being Hasidically inclined, I would have to say that Galut is so much more than just physically being in Eretz Yisrael, but that Galut is the Galut of the Hashem's presence in the world right now, and that our mentality and our consciousness is a Galut consciousness, whether we're living in Mea Shearim or in Toronto or wherever we are. So could you please address that?
Yes, I agree with that. Galut is obviously much more than just a local situation in which we find ourselves living among the non-Jews. I was quoting here Berkowitz. Berkowitz is of the opinion that now that we are back in Israel, we should indeed create a completely different halachic setting because we are back in Israel. Others will say to Berkowitz, and have said to Berkowitz, but Galut is also in Israel. In other words, we haven't yet gotten ourselves out of that. That's a long and very complicated story. I still would understand Berkowitz in the sense that since we now have sovereignty and we are living our own lives and we can decide ourselves how to live our lives and we don't have to bow down all the times to the goyim, to the non-Jews, to use that word for a moment, there are some very important changes which are extreme, which we now must take into account. The very fact that we are living in Israel, even when it's a secular state, does allow for possibilities, halachically, which were never possible within Galut. So this is a matter of debate. How far are you going? How far do you want to change things like that. Berkowitz took a quite an extreme stand there. Even Leibowitz, by the way, did, but in a very different sense of the word.
Okay. I wonder if you could address the danger inherent in leaving it up to an individual who exercises their autonomy to say, you know, that doesn't speak to me or this doesn't speak to me, because it really does threaten the whole system.
Yeah, I'm fully aware that this is a risky situation, the risky part of what I'm suggesting. But as I mentioned before, we should never forget the idea is not to make things easier. The idea is to make things more meaningful and deeper, right? I'm not looking for lenient opinions. I don't think that's the answer to the problem at all. I'm just saying more authenticity is required, more integrity is required. And if this approach would lead to that, then I would be very much in favor of that. Nothing in this world which will make any impact is without risks. You have to take a certain risk. And as I said at the very beginning, this is not for everybody. There are some people who need to live by conformity. They have to go to the normal school, and they can't go beyond that because they will lose it all. But I do know that there are many other people who would really like to see a change because they want to be authentic, and we must give them that opportunity.
Thank you.
If we could just combine the last two questions, right? Yes, you have a question too, right? Yeah, so
okay.
30 seconds or less.
Okay. Quick statement. I'm so angry and so disappointed I don't daven at all.
You don't?
I am so angry and so disappointed I don't daven at all.
You don't daven at all?
I don't daven at all. That doesn't mean I'm not in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But anyway, the question is that the obvious refutation to what you're saying, and I didn't hear you say it, was that we talk about how the rabbis of today do not have the greatness of the rabbis of the earlier rabbis.
Mm-hmm.
So how can the rabbis of today change the halacha of what the Tanaim and the Amoraim and so on?
Right.
Okay.
Mine touches on what you've spoken about, and that is, there's a struggle between following the ways of your fathers and, let's say, looking at yourself and looking at the world and thinking differently. And what comes to mind, for example, is a simple thing, but let's say kitniot.
Yes.
And on the one hand, feeling this is what your family has done. On the other hand, feeling, especially in Eretz Yisrael, there should be unity. And with this kind of thing, it causes more diversity.
Mm-hmm. Going back to number one, I fully, and I mean this very sincerely, fully understand your statement that you are so annoyed that you don't pray at all. I call that holy non-prayer. And I very much hear what you are saying there. And I think that also should be taken into account, especially after the Holocaust and what happened to us, and obviously what it brought about in our minds, in our hearts. That's one thing. The second thing is concerning the rabbis. I think that the rabbis need much more courage to stand up and not looking over their shoulders. And there are some who are not fully. At the moment in Israel, you definitely see a new generation of rabbis coming up who are doing much better than the older generation, right? And I think that if they would have the courage to do what I a little bit suggested here today, that would put them on that level or close to that level of the rabbis of a long time ago. Because if you look into their works and into their responsa, what they wrote, they did have courage. They had chutzpah. They broke through in certain things because they realized that otherwise the Jewish tradition would get stagnated. But we are living today in a situation where most rabbis are not prepared to do that. I found that extremely problematic. Pardon? Absolutely. That's right. Well, that's the reason why I'm standing here and why there's Torah in motion to protest against that. The question about Kitniot, very quickly. I don't know if you know where's the... The Kitniot issue, by the way, I don't know if you know about it. An Israeli, famous Israeli rabbi has written not so long ago a whole essay on this, saying indeed that we should do away altogether with the Kitniot business and that that is no longer, should no longer be applied. He got terribly attacked for this, left and right by his colleagues. But again, there is something to say for it. On the other side, I must say, what I'm a little bit concerned about is that if we again start to streamline things in Israel on a new level, then in a matter of time we have the same problem back again. I would like to keep that diversity. You want to hold my kidneys? Please do so. Yes, as long as you don't tell me that I'm a Sephardi, so I don't hold my kidney out in any way. But the very fact is that don't come and tell me that you are a better religious Jew because you happen to live, or you don't eat kidney out, or you don't eat gebrocht, and I do. Right? I think that we should allow people to decide themselves how to live their lives in that respect. Thank you very much.
We hope you found this recording a most enjoyable learning experience. We welcome your feedback. Please contact us at info@torahinmotion.org or at www.torahinmotion.org. Have a great day. Thank you.